Good morning. Today is Monday, April 6, 2026. This is Sandy reading for the Talking Information Center, and I'll be reading today's edition of the Salem News. The first article is called On the Hunt. The Pickering House hosted its annual Easter egg hunt on Saturday morning, this time with 1,500 eggs hidden around the beautiful gardens of the historic Salem home. The Easter Bunny also made an appearance of the day. Bishop Fenwick student is indicted. The Bishop Fenwick student, who is accused of breaking into a Danvers woman's home and stabbing her to death last month, was indicted in Salem Superior Court Thursday. Anthony DeMeo, 18, of Lynn, was indicted by a grand jury on charges of murder and home invasion. He is scheduled to be arraigned in Superior Court on May 11th at 9:30 a.m. DeMeo was originally arraigned on these charges in Salem District Court on March 13th, the day after he was arrested for the murder of 68-year-old Janet Swallow in what investigators called a seemingly random killing. On the afternoon of Thursday, March 12, police received a 911 call about the teen walking erratically down Standish Street in Lynn while holding a bloody knife. DeMeo told responding officers he had killed a woman in Danvers, a prosecutor said at his March 13th arraignment. DeMeo was taken to Salem Hospital. That evening, after Lynn police conducted a search warrant of his home and found clothing and cell phone evidence in line with his claim, Danvers officers and state police found Swallow dead inside her 17 Amherst Street home. This teen had broken in through a window the night before and stabbed Swallow while she was in bed, investigators said. There are no known ties between Swallow and her alleged killer. Swallow leaves behind two sons, a stepson, daughters-in-law, a granddaughter, siblings, and many beloved friends. She was a retired nurse who had spent decades working in intensive and critical care units and had a love of traveling. An online fundraiser has raised more than $60,000 for her family. DeMeo remains in custody at Bridgewater State Hospital. Attorney Kevin Reddington is representing him in Just So Human, Merrimack College Group unexpectedly meet the Pope. A Merrimack College Group answered when Pope Leo unexpectedly called upon it during a March pilgrimage to Italy. The annual trip called Pellegrinaggio has undergraduate and graduate students, alumni, faculty, staff, administrators, and other Augustinians pilgriming to Italy each spring. Its purpose is to walk the footsteps of St. Augustine and seek the Augustinian community. Leading up to the journey, students asked if there was a chance they'd be able to see the Pope, and the response was that it was unlikely due to the Pope's busy schedule his first year as pontificate. Francis Dory Manson, Merrimack College's Associate Vice President for Mission and Ministry and Holistic Formation, said. Near the end of the 9-day trip, the group attended a celebratory dinner in Rome on March 11th. The Reverend Joseph Farrell, the Prior General of the Order of St. Augustine, stopped by the dinner to say hello. At the end of dinner, he pulled aside the Reverend Raymond Dlugos, Merrimack College's Vice President for Mission and Ministry, and gave him an unexpected blessing. Earlier in the day, the Pope stopped his Popemobile to speak with Farrell, saying how he heard the college was in town. He asked for Farrell to arrange for him to meet the students and staff. When Dlugos returned to the group, he said the Pope requested to meet with them after lunch the next day. The room erupted in cheers, some tears of joy, and a lot of questions, Manson said. For one, the students on the trip were told to bring only comfortable clothing and wanted to know what to wear to see the Pope. Manson, on her fifth pilgrimage with the college, said everyone had sneakers and the students were told just to wear something nice. The group started the next day with things that, in and of themselves, would be once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. The group went to Mass in the catacombs underneath St. Peter's Basilica. Some students climbed its dome and later toured the excavations below St. Peter's Square, where the bones of St. Peter are kept. But around lunchtime, what was earlier considered unlikely became a reality. All of us understood the significance of the day, and we experienced a sense of gratitude and blessing from our meeting with Pope Leo, Manson said. They headed across the street to the Order of St. Augustine, General Curia, that sits outside the Vatican walls. Inside, the Pope was ready to meet them. Freshman Anthony Olio, 19, said everyone reviewed how to properly address the Pope as Your Holiness before entering the chapel to meet him. He recalled sitting in a pew waiting for the Pope's arrival and being in awe when he entered the room. I am thinking to myself, the most influential figure to my religion is standing in the same room as me, Olio said. I had no other thoughts in my head other than he is in the room with me right now and it doesn't feel real. The Pope, who met with the group for about 15 minutes in the Curia's chapel, led them in prayer before shaking hands with all the students. Olio was carrying hats with Merrimack College's insignia to gift people he met during the trip. He reached into his bag and held it in his hands behind his back before standing in front of Pope Leo. Olio remembered a smile coming across his face as he introduced himself, shook the Pope's hand, and presented the hat as a gift from the whole group. The moment was special to him, acting as the face of his college. The freshman said he felt the Pope knew he was extremely nervous as well as ecstatic, but made him feel comfortable. Olio was overcome with emotion and the experience. He called his mother and broke into tears. The encounter with the Pope meant plenty to him in his faith and life's journey, he said, and he felt he came full circle as a Catholic. Olio added how he felt gratitude toward his parents. He was raised Catholic, but found his way back into his faith a few years ago. I owe it all to my parents and especially my mom, Olio said. Growing up, she was the biggest teacher and influence on me and my faith and spiritual journey. Without her, I wouldn't have been in the position I was in to meet the Pope. Another student connected about her hometown in Michigan with Pope Leo, who knew exactly where she was talking about, Manson said. With this exalted figure of authority, he was still very much a gentle and kind human being, Manson said, about the Pope's down-to-earth conversations with members of the group. He's just so human. The Pope gave the Merrimack College audience a papal blessing and a message to send back to the United States and the college. His message was simple: be the bearers of peace in a divided world. Manson said she was impressed by his warmth and ability to convey a serious message at the same time. He addressed the audience, telling them he wanted to talk to them about what was going on in the world. We all sat back and knew we were receiving a very important message, she said. After meeting the Pope, Manson called her husband and told him she believed she was just in the presence of a saint. That was someone living out the human mission with such grace and humility, she said. That's what we're all called to be, and he's doing it. Report: employers paying cost of Trump's tariffs. President Donald Trump's global tariffs have cost Massachusetts businesses an average of nearly $200,000 since they were imposed a year ago, according to a new report from a good government group. The analysis by the Center for American Progress found that small business importers in Massachusetts have faced sharply rising costs, paying an average of $194,000 more in tariffs from March 2025 through February 2026 compared to the prior year. Tariff costs for small business importers have surged since early 2025, according to the report, forcing businesses across Massachusetts to raise prices, cut hiring, and delay growth. Nationally, small business importers have paid an average of $306,000 more over the past year, underscoring the widespread effect of the administration's trade agenda, the report indicates. Roughly 90% of tariffs are paid by U.S. importers and consumers, and more than 4 in 10 small businesses report tariff-related price increases affecting their operations, the report's authors noted. Small businesses employ nearly half of the U.S. workers and make up 97% of importers, leaving them exposed to rising trade costs. Small businesses are paying the price for the administration's failed trade strategy, Michael Negron, Senior Fellow for Economic Opportunity at the Center for American Progress and co-author of the analysis, said in a prepared statement. Despite promises that tariffs would lead to economic gains, the Trump administration has slammed small businesses and consumers with higher costs in every state. Trump's reciprocal tariffs, which were announced a year ago this week, have forced most major countries to broker new trade deals that repealed tariffs and non-tariff barriers on U.S. goods. The U.S. Supreme Court in February ruled that Trump's tariffs, his 10% baseline, and anti-fentanyl tariffs on China, Canada, and Mexico were illegal because they are not allowed by an emergency powers law. The president has kept those trade deals intact by threatening retaliation using different legal authorities and has temporarily imposed a new 15% baseline tariff on nations without a deal. On Thursday, Trump marked the one-year anniversary of his Liberation Day reciprocal tariff announcement by setting new levies on pharmaceuticals and steel. Trump signed orders imposing tariffs of up to 100% on foreign-made drugs and requiring steel to be tariffed at its U.S. market value instead of the lower cost of making it abroad, closing what White House officials described as a loophole in the trade system. Massachusetts businesses export about $77 billion worth of goods each year to more than 210 markets worldwide, according to industry figures. In deep blue Massachusetts, Trump's tariffs have prompted strong criticism over the past year from state leaders, labor unions, and some business groups who say consumers and employers are paying the price. Governor Mara Healey said the tariffs are a Trump tax on families and businesses that will mean higher costs on everything, from housing to cars to groceries to energy. Business leaders say Trump's on-again, off-again tariffs have roiled financial markets and lowered consumer confidence as employers struggle to adjust to the seesaw developments. Brooke Thompson, president and CEO of Associated Industries of Massachusetts, said the impact of the tariffs has added to other pressures on employers who rely on trade, ranging from lingering pinch of inflation and a sluggish labor market to the conflict in the Middle East. All of that has literally made employers say, you know what, I'm going to delay hiring, or I'm going to delay my capital projects, she said. We've talked to a lot of folks who say they're delaying these things because they just don't know what the costs are going to be in the future. Some employers have been forced to lay off employees, while others have raised their prices to offset the cost of the tariffs to their operations. Although there was some optimism initially after the Supreme Court ruling struck down most of the president's tariffs, that has waned as the reality sets in that businesses may not be fully compensated for the loss of revenue despite the high court's decision, Thompson said. We're talking about $166 billion in eligible potential refunds, she said. I mean, let's be honest, this will play out in court, but if that were to come to fruition, there would be some serious borrowing on behalf of the federal government to pay that tab. New Gloucester, Maine donates over $3,000 to fishing vessel Lily Jean Fund. Two residents of New Gloucester, Maine traveled to Gloucester on Cape Ann to donate more than $3,000 to the fishing vessel Lily Jean Fund. The Gloucester-based Lily Jean was returning to port when it sank the morning of January 30 and about 25 miles off the coast without a mayday. Of the seven hands aboard the vessel, only the body of Captain Accursio Gus Sanfilippo was recovered. Also lost were Paul Beale and his son Paul Beale Jr., John Rosanidis, Freeman Short, Sean Therrien, and NOAA fishery observer Jada Samet. New Gloucester residents Kimberly Brousseau and Beverly Cadigan presented Mayor Paul Lundberg with a check for $3,282, all of which was raised by the town's 6,000 residents. The donation also included sympathy cards and gift bags from Maine Fudge for each family affected. The Fishing Vessel Lily Jean Fund was established by the Gloucester Fishing Community Preservation Fund to assist the families of those lost in the tragedy. All money raised is being divided equally among. Water billing issue causes Peabody to charge for 4 months' use in April. An issue with upgrading the city's water billing system means customers will see 4 months of water usage reflected on their April bills instead of the usual three, Major Ted Betancourt said. The city has shifted its water billing system to a new software platform called Munis, but a snafu with this switch delayed sending out bills and caused others to reflect the cost of 4 to 5 months of usage rather than three. Betancourt said in a statement Friday, the good news, we've made significant progress and we expect to be fully back on our normal 3 month billing schedule by the time second quarter bills go out in August, he said in a statement. All April bills will reflect 4 months of usage to keep billing schedules consistent as a result of this issue. I'm sorry for the angst and confusion this may have caused you, and I truly appreciate your patience. This is a critical upgrade of a system that serves our entire city, and we want to make sure it delivers the results we expect. For questions or concerns, call Betancourt's office at 978-538-5700. Danvers resident named five-star wealth manager for a seventh year in a row. The Bullfinch Group recently announced that Danvers resident Jake Akori, CFP, MBA, CLTC, AAMS, has earned the designation of five-star wealth manager. The five-star wealth manager award is annually given to financial managers who are identified through research conducted with peers and firms. The program analyzes internal and external research data, including a survey to more than 3,000 registered financial services professionals and all local financial service companies registered with FINRA and or the SEC to select each year's winners, nominated wealth managers who satisfied a total of 10 objective eligibility and evaluation criteria are awarded this title. Akuri has offices in both Topsfield and Needham. He earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Maine and an MBA from Fordham University's Graduate School of Business Administration. Earning the 5-star wealth manager designation is a powerful statement to Jake's dedication to putting clients first. His work consistently elevates the financial lives of the individuals, families, and business owners he serves, and we are proud to celebrate this well-deserved recognition, said Kevin Schneider, CLU, principal of the Bullfinch Group. Artemis II symbolizes a half-century of change. Same destination, different country. The nation that dares to send an Orion space vessel on a pioneering orbit around the moon is a far different place from the one that first ventured there and placed the original footprints on the lunar surface. It is bigger, and yet its dreams are smaller. It is richer, and yet the character of its civic life is poorer. It is more powerful, and yet its influence is more constricted. It is smugger, and yet its confidence has been compromised. No one who trod the earth in 1969 would recognize the United States in 2026. In a sense, that's not remarkable. No one who lived in 1912 would recognize America in the lunar landing of 1969, another 57-year span of great change that took automobiles from steam power to gasoline, that took American movie theaters from the Keystone Cops to Easy Rider, and that would see the country grow from an afterthought in power politics to superpower status. Even so, the comparison between the United States of Apollo 11 and the United States of Artemis II is an instructive venture, providing insights into their own time, even as it illuminates the distance the country has traveled from the Archies, Sugar Sugar, to Taylor Swift, The Fate of Ophelia, from the median purchase price of a home of $25,900 to $405,300, from Tom Seaver to Paul Skeens, from Richard Nixon to Donald Trump, from a typewriter ribbon, roughly $2.50 in a stationery store, to a 2-pack USB-C fast charger block for a laptop, $21.99 on Amazon.com. Along the way, gasoline at 39 cents, roughly $3 in today's dollars, has been replaced by gas soaring beyond $4 per gallon. Presidential views have shifted from Nixon's state dinner toast to the Shah of Iran honoring a nation and a people with whom we are proud to stand as friends and allies, to Trump's characterization of Iran's theocratic leaders, a vicious group of very hard, terrible people, from mainframe vacuum tube computers occupying vast air-conditioned rooms to iPhones that slip into purses and pockets, and now vast AI data centers requiring massive cooling operations. One surprise, the phrase artificial intelligence was already 14 years old in 1969. In 1955, 2 years before the Soviet Union began a space age by launching Sputnik into orbit, a group of scholars proposed the Rockefeller Foundation fund an effort to develop technology to form abstractions and concepts, solve kinds of problems now reserved for humans, and improve themselves, explaining, "We think that a significant advance can be made in one or more of these problems if a carefully selected group of scientists work on it together for a summer." That proposal for a summer project has become what you might think of as an endless summer, ironically the title of a popular film released in 1966, the year of Neil Armstrong's first space flight aboard Gemini 8. The gap between Apollo 11 and Artemis 2 is so wide that conservatism, the social and political creed that once was a shorthand for resistance to change, has changed in dramatic fashion. The conservatism of 1969 was led by figures such as Ronald Reagan, then the governor of California, Barry Goldwater, back in the Senate after losing the 1964 presidential election, Gerald Ford, House Minority Leader, whose furthest horizon of imagination didn't include the presidency he would occupy 5 years later, and William F. Buckley, Jr., involved that year in a heated debate with left-leaning Noam Chomsky on Vietnam and still feuding with Gore Vidal. In the White House was Nixon, whose brand of conservatism intersects with that of Trump, mainly in their visceral hatred of communism. But Nixon's conservatism had room for supporting an income floor for all Americans, a notion that would be anathema to Trump. The two presidents' temperaments couldn't be more different, one an introvert and brooder, but, as the White House tapes showed, only temporarily tethered to the textbook personal reserve and sense of private correctness of many conservatives. And the other, a voluble figure, prone to explosions of withering commentary and public denunciation of his foes. One was a shrewd foreign policy thinker, the other an intuitive man of action. One struggled against a Democratic-controlled Congress, the other dominated a Republican-controlled Congress. One vetoed the War Powers Act, which was passed over his veto. The other ignored it completely.